step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Ghost Hunting in New England.
Your favorite spooky podcast.
Hello and happy Wednesday. Welcome to this week's episode of Ghost Hunting in New England with your hosts, Amelia.
And Beth.
How are you this week, Beth?
I'm okay, Amelia. It's weird to be recording on a Monday. I had to go to the office today. I had to see people. It was terrible. I had to take the train.
Bummer.
I know. And all of a sudden, now we're recording on an off night and like, oh, I'm all messed up. How are you?
I'm great. I went outside today and in front of my house, three little daffodils have come up, which is such a pleasant, nice welcome to spring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
They're all like the snowdrops and the crocuses and all those other little flowers, like the happy little ones. Yeah. But I feel like when you see that daffodil, you're like, all right, we're in spring now.
Yeah. It doesn't snow again once you get daffodils.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
Made me feel really good. Yeah. I'm feeling good about it.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
So what are we talking about this week, Beth?
In general, I think we're talking about Vermont. I don't know if I can make it any more specific than that.
Yeah, we just got some haunted stories out of the great state of Vermont. Can I make a shout out? It's like a corrections corner shout out that I have to do.
Right off the top. Okay.
Shout out to my dad because he listened to our episode about Maine, where I said, you always talk about how much I love Maine, but Vermont's really my favorite state. And I think my dad was a little hurt because we went to Maine a lot while I was a kid. So I would like to shout out dad that we're talking about Vermont, but you know what? Vacation lands in my heart.
Okay.
It's in my heart. Yeah. I love Maine. I love Vermont. I love a lot of places.
I'm glad you like a lot of places.
I do. Yeah. And God bless me. Listens to all of our episodes. So, hey, dad.
Hi, Uncle Warren. Well, so again, this week, Vermont.
Would you like to start us off, Beth?
I don't know. I have like a really like weirdo story.
Cool.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess we'll do this one first. So here on your favorite spooky podcast, we do talk about some really wild stuff, ghosts, psychics, folklore, even a little crypto for some flavor now and then. But this might actually be my favorite one yet. This is the man-eating stone of Glastonbury Mountain.
Wow.
So Glastonbury Mountain is part of the Appalachian Trail. And when I started looking into the information for this week, I had to go back and listen to Haunted Hikes from season 3, because this particular part of the trail up where Glastonbury Mountain is called Long Trail. And I was sure that we had talked about it on that episode. But no, we actually just talked about Spearfinger and the New Jersey Devil. They were both outstanding stories. And so you should go back to season 3 and listen to them. But it was very relieving for me because I get digging. Anyway, the first thing that I found out was that this area of the world is called the Bennington Triangle. And Amelia had actually mentioned when we were brainstorming for this season that she and Jamie are thinking about doing an episode on Lost Souls of America this season featuring the Bennington Triangle. So head over there for the deeper details. I'm just going to give you kind of the overview and the basics. So the Bennington Triangle is a coin. The Bennington Triangle is a term coined by Joseph Citro in 1992, or it might be Citro, Joseph Citro in 1992. He was giving an NPR interview about the area, and he used it to refer to this kind of general area within the Green Mountains of southern Vermont. And the area is not really much more defined than that. It's not like it runs from this town to this town, you know, or over here and includes this body of water. It's just sort of like Bennington, Vermont, that area. And it happens to include this mountain. But so within this very loosely identified area, we do have a little bit of history. The Algonquin people lived here since about 8500 BC. So that's about 10,000 years that they lived in this area. They avoided this Bennington Triangle area at all costs. It was actually thought to be home to a Wendigo. Amelia, do we know what a Wendigo is? Have we talked about Wendigos before?
We have not covered those yet.
Oh, should I spoil the surprise? Or
I think you should talk about it. Yeah, if it's in your story.
Okay. It was thought to be home to a Wendigo, a cannibal ice giant who tears through towns and eats all the residents, which is a pretty impressive thing to be. And I was telling my family about this over dinner before I came over, and my brother-in-law goes, not to be confused with the abominable snowman, which I thought was kind of funny. But at the same time, I had read some of the legends about the Wendigo, and the legends always kind of come down to, so they kill the Wendigo and the townspeople, you know, pick the whole thing apart. And inside there is actually a, what used to be a person, right? Who was like transformed into this giant evil ice giant. Anyway, though, so that was kind of the story of the Wendigo. When the Europeans colonized the area, the Algonquin warned them to stay away from that Bennington Triangle area. However, it was a really great source of logging because it had never been lived in, it had never been farmed. And so by the mid-1890s, a couple of towns sprung up there, Glastonbury Town and Somerset. The towns got up and running, and they had a single summer season there when a flood wiped out the whole area in 1898. All the bridges and railroads were wiped out, and then the towns just dried up. Currently, the unincorporated area has 4 people living there. They're all one family, is my understanding, so they just stayed on after everybody else moved away. I kind of wonder what that's like to live in an unincorporated area. Like, who plows the road? Do I have to plow the road? Write in and tell us. Do you live in an unincorporated area? What's it like there? Then in the stretch of time from 1945 to 1950, 5 different people mysteriously disappeared in this area, and 4 of those bodies were never found. So this is what brings us to the man-eating stone of Glastonbury Mountain. Apparently, this is what the Algonquins were warning the settlers away from. They knew there was some deep, dark force going on in the woods, but they didn't really know what it was, so they just stayed away. And so Joseph Citro, that same author that we talked about back with the Bennington Triangle, he wrote a book called The Vermont Monster Guide, and here's what he says about the man-eating stone of Glastonbury Mountain. No one alive has seen this dangerous anomaly on Glastonbury Mountain. Native Americans knew of it and warned people away. We can only imagine it as a sizable rock, large enough to stand on. But when someone stands upon it, the rock becomes less solid and, like a living thing, swallows the unfortunate trespasser. A number of disappearances have been reported on Glastonbury Mountain. Could all these vanished folks have stepped inadvertently on this hungry stone? So, wow. Quicksand rock. Amelia, I don't feel so bad now about not going out in nature. Could you imagine getting swallowed up like by a whole rock?
No. That doesn't sound like a nice walk in the park.
No. And what if it wasn't even quicksand, but more like a Venus flytrap where it like comes up and smashes together and traps you inside?
That's kind of more how I was looking at it.
Really? Yeah. I mean, I at first was thinking of it as quicksand, but then the more I thought about it, I was like, but even more than that, where do you think you would go?
I don't know.
Oh, come on. Let's make a guess. Where do you think you would go?
I don't know. What's your guess?
I have absolutely no idea, but I bet it is another dimension somewhere. Whatever it is that swallowed you up into that hole, it's not of this world.
Mm-mm.
No. So a couple more things. I did try very hard to actually find more information about this monster, the man-eating stone of Glastonbury Mountain. And every single thing that I could find about it actually referred back to this passage from Joseph Citro's book, The Vermont Monster Guide, which was published in 2009.
How does he spell his name?
C-I-T-R-O.
I think it's Citro.
Yeah.
Like citrus.
Well, I thought that too. And then I watched a couple of videos about him and like with him. And I'm pretty sure they said Citro. That's why I was saying it.
Okay.
It seems very unnatural to me as well.
Yeah, that doesn't It doesn't sound like a real name.
No. C-I-T-R-O. Oh, so everything that is written about this man-eating rock apparently is based on this 2009 book that just had that one little passage that I shared with you. Like, I couldn't find anything older than that. So I would love to know where he got the information from. That would have been fascinating.
Also, call him up and have him on the show.
I bet we could. He seems like a cool guy. You know, yeah, he's like out there on like YouTube videos walking around. And he was one of the people who I watched a video on for my other story tonight, too.
Wow.
He's very well known in Vermont paranormal stuffs.
Cool.
But I also just want to bring up, there were an obscene number of articles about different people all over the world who are eating rocks.
Yeah.
Because I had to Google man eating rock, right? Man eating stone. So
it's a big thing. It's a big problem.
Why are people eating rocks?
It's pica. People eat all kinds of things. Mental disorder.
I am familiar with pica, but that seems really like too many people are out there eating rocks.
Agreed.
I know there's a lot of bad things that go on in the world, but that seems like something that needs some serious attention and research toward getting people to stop eating rocks. That's not good for you. Anyway, that's about all I have to say about Glastonbury Mountain and the man-eating rock of Glastonbury Mountain. Except don't go there because you might get eaten by a mountain rock. And in which case, if you come back, could you please tell us what happened? Because I've got to know.
Yeah, like if it happens to you, like keep your cell phone on you so that way you can like send pics.
Oh, yeah, we definitely want pictures. But more importantly, you just like record everything going on, your inner thoughts and everything, and just send it right in. Email it to ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com and we will play it on the show.
Good story, Beth.
Thanks.
It's good. Okay, so my main story tonight is on the Eddy House, which isn't actually haunted, but you will see how it fits in with the whole show today. So just full disclosure right off the bat, I got most of my research from this. I got it from a few different places, but most of it was from the Woodstock History Center's webpage up in Woodstock, Vermont. And they have a fabulous website. So go shout out to them. Go check them out. That's where I got all this info. Okay, so the Eddy House was originally the home of Zephaniah Eddy, whose three children descended from a long line of psychics. From a young age, the children named William, Horatio, and Mary were mediums and played with ghost children, went into trances, spoke in spirits of voices, and were eventually expelled from school for levitating desks and making books fly through the air. So what we're going to be focusing tonight is William and Horatio Eddy. Now, I found this story very interesting because there's really no more mention of their sister Mary, despite her also seeming to have these abilities. And later on in the story, we're going to hear a little bit about their mother and grandmother, who also aren't mentioned anywhere, and we don't have any information on them. So William and Horatio Eddy spent their early years on a farm just outside of Rutland, Vermont. Their occult powers were supposedly first made apparent while the brothers were still infants. Various reports would indicate that the boys would disappear from their cradles and mysteriously reappear in other parts of the house. Later, the boys became a little older. They would go on to trances and other spiritual materializations would appear about them. When they went to school, items would allegedly levitate. They'd be thrown across the room. They were just doing all kinds of things, really disrupting the class. And it all eventually led to the boys being banned from school, as this was the early 1800s, and people thought this was the work of the devil. It wasn't just anyone who thought that, but the boy's own father, Zephaniah, believed that that's what this was. To drive away the spirits, he started starving the boys, beating the boys, pouring boiling water over the boys even.
Yeah, we call that a mandated reporting event nowadays.
Yeah, horrific child abuse.
Yes.
And as the old saying goes, when someone's doing the work of the devil, if you can't beat him, join him. So unable to rid the boys of their behavior, he stopped beating them and started exploiting them. He sold them to a traveling sideshow where they worked as mediums. For 14 years, William and Horatio traveled throughout North America and Europe, where they often met with abuse as skeptics tried to awaken them from their trances by drastic measures such as punching them, or believing that they were frauds or instruments of the devil, would stone them, beat them, burn them, and even, on a few accounts, shot at them with guns.
What is wrong with people?
In the 1800s. The crazy time to be alive. So that would happen. But they also had this following, especially in northern United States and Canada. So eventually the father passed away and the brothers returned back to their home. They converted the farm into an inn known as the Green Tavern Inn, where they would take in guests for $8 a week. It was at this inn that the boys really became famous because they started holding seance type shows, which they would supposedly conjure up spirits of the departed who would interact with people in the room. No money was charged for these encounters. In 1874, as reports of the strange happenings were spreading far and wide, a writer for the Daily Graphic named Henry Alcott decided to investigate. Alcott was an avid skeptic and went in hoping to debunk the whole situation. But as he delved more and more into the family history, he learned that several generations of William and Horatio's family had supposedly shown occult powers, including the boys' mother and grandmother. Now, again, who is the mother? Who is the grandmother? And why aren't we talking about the sister? I just assume it's because it's the 1800s and no one cared about women.
If they were thought to be witches, you would think that actually they would have cared about them. But that strikes me as just very, very chauvinist. Let's only
That's
pay
what
attention.
I mean.
Let's only pay attention to the boys and let's put them in a circus. And did you say that they moved back in with their father?
The father died and they took over the farm.
Gotcha. Okay.
And made it into an inn. Yeah.
Okay.
So over a 10-week period, this guy Alcott studied the family and the apparitions that would appear during the seances. He failed to find any evidence of fraud, and he enlisted a team of experts that included engineers and carpenters, and no one could find any logical reason why these things were occurring.
Other than the fact that they were mediums, which is a perfectly logical reason.
I totally agree.
They were very powerful mediums.
So while he really believed it, I mean, he became a true believer, many others remained super skeptical about any of this. Some people even saying that it started out as real and then like to make more money, they started like hamming it up. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
But in the 1870s, they became so famous that the town this was in, Chittenden, got the title of the spirit capital of the universe.
Ooh.
Yes. So they're really credited with starting kind of the spiritualist movement up in Vermont. So the house is still there today, and it's actually part of the High Life Ski Lodge. And I kind of dove into that a little bit, and it doesn't appear to be haunted now. Like, no one talks about it. It's just known as this spot where spiritualism really took off in the state of Vermont because of these brothers.
Nice.
And that's the story of the Eddy House.
That was great.
Thanks.
So I have one that I don't have written. So I have to just wing it. Sometimes this goes well. Sometimes it doesn't.
Beth, how many episodes have you had everything written?
Not many.
Almost none. Almost none.
All right. So for my next story, I'm going to start off by telling you about Mrs. Kellogg. Now, this is not Kellogg of the cereal Kellogg's. This is just Mrs. Kellogg, because I can't remember her first name, from Montpelier, Vermont. And so Mrs. Kellogg lived in Montpelier. I guess she was not Mrs. Kellogg. She was Miss Kellogg because she had no children. She had two brothers, and one of the brothers had a son, John. These are the main players in our story. Now, Miss Kellogg got old. She was really, really wealthy. She had like $300,000 in her estate. So in the 1890s, $300,000 is equivalent to about $9 million today.
Woo-hoo.
Okay, so she had some money. She decided to leave all of her money to the town of Montpelier because she loved Montpelier. And she specifically was going to build a library in Montpelier.
Did you know I had my first crepe in Montpelier?
I did not.
First crepe I ever had.
Excellent. I've driven through Montpelier a number of times. I've never actually stopped there.
It's a lovely little town. I'm sure. 10 out of 10 stars. Highly recommend.
Excellent. Well, they were out $300,000 because her brother's son, John, her nephew, basically went to court and contested the will after she died. And he read some bogus probate documents. He got his uncle and his father to sign over their rights to the money to him. So the town agreed to a $30,000 payout, which comes to about $1 million nowadays, and they were going to use it to build a library in the town. So
listeners, don't let this happen to you. If you have any probate will issues and you live in the state of Massachusetts, give Paul Schwartzman a call. TwinPineLaw.com. TwinPineLaw.com.
Like two trees?
Like two pine trees. TwinPineLaw.com.
So he was extra obnoxious even with the building of this library because he insisted that the library had to have his name on it. So instead of it being the Kellogg Library, it is now the Memorial Kellogg-Hubbard Library because he's just a greedy, weaselly guy. And that was really his reputation in town was he was just yucky. Anyway, so he basically steals the money from the town and then he dies about 10 years later. Interestingly enough, do you know who he left all the money to?
His sister.
The town.
Whoa, ba-da-da, ba-da.
So, it was just this guy's ego. He just wanted to be the name on donating the $9 million to the town.
Dang.
What a weasel.
Blech. Dr. Phil did a thing about that. It's like a specific type of narcissism that only centers around philanthropy.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting?
I suppose there's a disorder for everything now.
Yeah, it's a narcissism around philanthropy, and it's for that reason. It's like people who need to be the name on like the hospital wing need to be the name on the fundraiser, but they don't actually like care about what they're raising the money for. Like, I'm sure this guy never went to the library. He just needed his name on the library.
Right. He just wanted everybody to know his name.
Yeah.
Think he was a generous guy, even though he was just a greedy, weaselly guy. Anyway, so when he died, he said that he wanted a statue at his grave. He has a very sort of elaborate grave as well. It's instead of being, you know, you think of a grave, it's got like a headstone and then there's grass. Where the grass would usually be is like this complete like cement, like sarcophagus type of thing, but it's like half submerged in the ground. And then there's like a sitting area and then there's a wall. And on the wall, there's this statue built. So the statue is referred to as Black Agnes. Now, interestingly enough, the statue is neither black nor a woman. It's actually made of copper, so it's green. And the name Agnes comes from the fact that when they built the statue, they actually copied one that was already built in Washington, D.C., Baltimore, that sort of area. And that one is referred to as Agnes because it's on the grave of a man named Felix Agnes. And that statue actually did turn black. So it was called Black Aggie. Follow me?
Cool.
So the Black Aggie name on the statue in Baltimore apparently followed to the lookalike statue here in Vermont. So one of the other things that started to happen is some of the curses, rumors, superstitions around Black Aggie in Baltimore also started to get associated with the death statue here in Vermont. Oh, that's what the statue really is. It's death.
Hmm? Why is it death?
So one of the other things that's there on the tomb is a piece of poetry by William Cullen Bryan. So this was a really well-known poem at the time of Hubbard's death. And so he had it inscribed in his tomb. So he would be thought of to be like a literary type and, you know, an academic. Everybody would have known this poem. It's called Thanatopsis, right? Which means thoughts on death. Thou go not like the quarry slave at night, scourged to his dungeon, but sustained and soothed by an unfaltering trust. Approach thy grave like one who wraps the drapery of his couch about him and lies down to pleasant dream. That's just the part that's inscribed on the tomb. But so that doesn't sound like someone who's afraid of death, thinks that he shouldn't be dying or anything, right? Like that's kind of like this is a man who's saying like, I am meeting death as an equal. Did you read Harry Potter?
No.
Did you watch Harry Potter?
You know, I did neither of those things.
Okay. Anyway, listeners, in The Deathly Hallows, you know how the story ends with the one with the invisibility cloak walks off you know, and finds death, and they walk off into time hand in hand, right? So I kind of got that same impression based on the poem that's there. You know, like this guy was, he was okay with the fact that he was dying and it wasn't going to be a big deal for him, right? He died, he was 53 years old. So it's not like he was like an old man who had been expecting it for a long time, but yet he had enough foresight to know that like he wanted this poem on his grave. He wanted a statue. He set aside certain monies for it. Like it was all a very big thing. Anyway, now on to Black Agnes, the curse of Black Agnes. Supposedly, if you are brave enough to go on a full moon at midnight and sit in Black Agnes's lap, you will die within 7 days and you will take 7 of your friends with you. If you go and sit in her lap at midnight on a full moon and yada, yada, all that stuff that I said, you will have 3 strokes of bad luck. You will have an uncountable amount of bad luck. Again, you will die within 7 days. It could be 7 months. It could be 7 years, but you will be dying eventually. And it might be on a 7. I just found like 2 really silly things this week and I'm not really sure what to do with them. But yeah, that's the legend of the Black Angus, Black Agnes. Wow. Yeah.
So, do you know how it started to be said you would die in 7 days and 7 of your friends would also die?
Because it was just a rumor that got started around the one in Baltimore and then it just followed it here.
Oh,
so right. It's not like anything ever happened to anybody around it. And I couldn't really find anything about the one in Baltimore either. But I don't think that one was necessarily as like weirdly thought about as this one. It's such a strange thing. But then there's videos all over YouTube of all these people who go and sit on her lap. But you know what? All those videos are of people sitting on her lap during the day.
Wow.
And then I never see a follow-up video from them either.
Ba-da-da.
So who knows?
Who knows?
Maybe you sit in Black Agnes's lap and then you get swallowed up by the man-eating stone of Glastonbury Mountain.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Could happen.
We could ask the Eddie twins about it if they were still alive.
They died like
yeah,
over 100 years ago. But that's okay. So good story.
You have another little.
It's like so little. It was more like something funny happened.
It's a tasty morsel.
It was funny. And it's funny because you brought up the whole Bennington Triangle thing earlier. And so I had been looking up these stories, right, for tonight's show and like haunted Vermont. And we've covered a lot of haunted stuff in Vermont.
We have.
In the past like 95 episodes, however many episodes we've had, a tremendous amount. So I'm like kind of having trouble. I'm like looking through and I come across the Black Lantern Inn and I'm looking at it and there's like not a ton of information out there. So I kind of skipped over it, right? And then I get an email from Jamie this morning from Lost Souls of America. She was sending me the show notes, the episode we recorded right before this one. And this girl, Brianna Maitland, that was the last place she was seen on March 19th, 2004, was the Black Lantern Inn.
Wow.
I'm like, what are the chances of that? I'm like, we're talking about haunted places in Vermont in 2 hours.
Crazy.
I thought it was crazy.
Yeah.
So I figured I'd tell you a little bit about the Black Lantern Inn because I figured it was like a sign.
Okay.
So here's the little teeny tiny bit from it. So the Black Lantern Inn was founded in 1803. The building is actually on the National Register of Historic Places. It's formerly known as the Montgomery House, and it was owned for 2 decades by Montgomery residents, Alan and Rita Kelsmith. But once they sold the historic building, it quickly passed through a series of owners until it closed abruptly in 2015, with rumors going around that it was going to become a private residence. However, following that closure, a group of locals began hatching a plan to open the doors. The community came together to purchase the house and to reopen the inn. And it is now open today by those people. It is haunted by someone who loves to take a shower. The shower in room 3 spontaneously turns on and off. And despite several plumbers looking into the matter, no issues have ever been discovered. And that is the very quick, little teeny tiny Black Lantern Inn being haunted. That's literally all the information on it. And it is on every single, like, 17 most haunted spots in Vermont. Plan your best Vermont haunted road trip.
And there's no information.
And that's it. That's literally all the information.
Anything else?
No, that's it.
Do we have any mail?
We do have some mail. So this message comes to us from our good friend, Tammy, the real estate agent. I just listened to your episode on 2022 predictions. I want to tell you about this insane premonition I had. Snippets of my dreams have always come true, but this was totally different. I was driving and zoned out, like road hypnosis. I had this vision while I was zoned out that I was laying on a stretcher and I could hear medical noises all around. And someone said we had gotten T-boned, but the truck saved my life. So the rest of my drive, I was super cautious. Then that night, I'm out with my husband and we're at this intersection with a red arrow to go left. Arrow turns green and he starts to go. And the people going straight decide to run the red light. My husband didn't notice and I threw my arm out and shouted, "Stop!" And he slammed on the brakes and turned the wheel and they missed T-boning the side of the truck by less than a foot.
Wow.
Tell Beth to read the book Psychic Witch by Matt Aurion. Aurion? I don't know how to say that. A-U-R-Y-N?
I don't know.
It's so good. And he has all these exercises on how to meditate to make your clairvoyancy stronger. It might help her strengthen her dream gift, like she mentioned.
Ooh, thanks for the tip.
Yeah, thanks, Tammy. And great story.
I like that too. That was a good story. I like stories where people come out okay.
And you know what else? We've been saying this season, like, oh, we're so sad. No one's leaving us reviews. I'm on Spotify. We have 13 new reviews on there.
Yeah?
Yeah, but you don't like leave comments. So it's like nothing you can read. But thanks everyone who left us a review on Spotify.
Thanks, everybody.
Please leave us a review on, you can leave it on Facebook, you can leave it on Spotify, you can leave one on Apple Podcasts, you can leave us a 15-star review on Audible.
Those are very impressive.
Yeah.
And you can leave really long comments on Audible too.
And on Apple Podcasts. And we'd love to hear it. We'd love to read it.
And if you don't think we deserve 5 stars, Amelia will tell you what to do.
Send us a private message telling us what we can do to make the show better for you. Don't leave us 3 stars. That's just rude. And speaking of kind of rude, if you're a waitress in a restaurant and someone pays for their bill with $100, don't just assume that's your tip. So this Stop weekend, it, I was, and like shout out to every waitress because it's such a hard job and I hate doing it. So I give them credit and I like didn't make a scene. I didn't ask for the money. I was just like, that was super weird. But we went out to brunch, which we don't really get to do very often, Paul and I, my husband. And so we go to brunch, my favorite spot. And he's been putting up with me lately. I've been a little like cranky. So I'm like, I'll get this. And I have this $100 bill. Hard to break 100 these days. So the waitress comes, I get rid of my $100 bill. And it was a $67 bill. Just
she didn't bring you any change at all.
No change at all. And like I had ordered a dessert to go. So she like came back with my dessert after that and was like, have a really great day, you guys. And like cleared the table. And Paul and I were like looking at each other. And I was like, that was very generous of me. I mean, I'm a good tipper, but it's not usually like 33%, but that's okay. I mean, you know, the food was great. So there you go.
Well, and that's great. And next time you go there, if she's your waitress again, just let her know that you tipped her last time.
Pay with a card. We literally were like staring at each other. It's like, all right, well. I happen to know that this place pulls tips for their wait staff. So that made me feel like a little better about it, but whatever.
So when I was waitressing like a million years ago, I had that happen to me once. I picked up a check off a table and the lady said, "You're all set," which I interpreted to mean it was all set.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my last table. So I cashed out and I went home.
Mm-hmm.
And I get back the next day and they're like, that table that you had at number 47 or wherever it was, you didn't bring them their change and you owe, Tammy $15 because she had to give it to them. In typical waitress, like catty form, it was the only thing that anybody could talk about. Mm-hmm. And no less than 4 people, none of them being Tammy or whatever her name was, came up to tell me that I owed her the money.
Yeah, I know. I know.
I don't know. I really have no idea at all.
And that was part of it. Like, that's part of why I didn't say anything. Cause I'm like, am I really going to like mortify this person over like $30?
You know, she probably just forgot to bring you your change.
That's it. But we assumed it was like maybe some misunderstanding, but someone gave us an $80 tip at Crate Berry like a month ago. And like, I like almost couldn't even take it. Cause like, I was the person who like did the exchange. I was like, are you sure about this? She's like, yeah, I'm in here all the time. And I
the people that come into your shop can probably afford $80 tips.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was one of those things like she comes in a lot, not like every day, but like enough. And she's like, I never have cash on me. So,
So it was like a year's worth of tips.
Yeah. It was like for a while.
Okay.
She was just, I think she was in a good mood. someone else was like crying in the restaurant. She was like, she was basically like, someone came in crying and they were leaving. And she's like, she handed me $100 and was like, I want to pay for their breakfast and just take the rest for a tip. Yeah, it was really nice.
That is nice.
Yeah. But anyway, Beth, you got anything else?
I don't think I have anything else. No.
All right. Well, everyone, thank you so much for listening. As always, you can leave us an email at ghostsendinginnewengland@gmail.com. Check out our website, ghostsendinginnewengland.com, on Instagram at ghostsendinginnewengland, on Facebook, ghostsendinginnewengland. No, on Facebook, facebook.com/ghosthuntinginnewengland, and on Twitter at ghosthuntingne. Tell a friend about the show and leave us a review. If you need to send us some snail mail, send your carrier pigeon right on over to Miss Pancake's house. And as always,
happy hunting.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.